On this episode of Skeptico, medium Stephanie A. Stevens discusses her involvement in the open source science medium experiment.
What I believe is when it's activated and everything is that it goes into a much higher realm, and I believe that, I know it pulls in people from the other side.
Stay with us for Skeptico.
Welcome to Skeptico, where we explore controversial science with leading researchers, thinkers, and their critics. I'm your host, Alex Sakaris, and on this episode, we're going to dig into the medium experiment I introduced you to in the last episode, and you're going to hear from Stephanie A. Stevens, one of the mediums who's participating in the experiment. Now, if you haven't heard the last episode, you might want to go back and give a listen to that one first, because we're going to jump right into the middle of things today, and we're going to more or less assume that everyone's up to speed. And I have to tell you, this is exactly the kind of episode I've been looking forward to for a long time, because we're getting to the point where we're talking about stuff that's happening right now rather than rehashing unresolvable cases from the past. And I'm also excited that we're starting to shift roles a little bit and move you, the listener, into the role of a collaborator in this research. And that's starting to happen. It's starting to happen in the online experiment that many of you have taken part of, and it's happening on the Skeptico forum and on the Open Source Science website. So I want to use this podcast to further that process of engaging you in this experiment, because I know what we can produce collectively can be really special. Now, in that spirit of collaboration, let me begin by responding to some of the feedback we've received about the open source element of this project. Now, most folks thought that the ideas that I laid out in the last episode as a way of moving this experiment forward, most people thought that was a great idea. It speeds up the process, gives us this concept of iteratively improving things and collaborative communication, make things go a lot faster, a lot smoother. But some were, let's say, a little skeptical, mainly for three reasons. The first had to do with authority. Folks wondered, why were certain decisions made the way they were? Second, folks were concerned about speed. Why weren't they being told things that they wanted to know? And also related to that was the issue of transparency. They wondered what they were going to be allowed to know and who was really controlling the information. And these were all very valid concerns. And I wanted to address them. And I think the best way to do that, I thought about this, was to really give some perspective to those issues relative to how skeptics and believers have collaborated in the past. So the best example I could think of, and the one that I know probably the most about because I had covered it in such depth on Skeptico over the last year, is the Sheldrick Wiseman telepathic dog experiment, right? So what I thought we'd do is take a minute and look at each one of these issues and look at them through the lens of that experiment and then discuss how we might do things differently, hopefully better, in this one. And I'm hoping this will provide a real grounding for what we're doing and explain it in real practical terms. Okay, so issue number one, authority or leadership. Now, at first glance, you might be tempted to associate open source concepts, open sourcing, with a lack of leadership, lack of central control. But that's not really true. The best open source projects, like Linux, for example, have a very clear, very strong direction and a very clear structure with regard to decision making. But what makes open sourcing different is that this authority is balanced with a very strong drive towards openness and collaboration all the way up the chain of command. So you need to have one vision, and it's fine and great to collaborate, but there's got to be one central hub, one ultimate authority, or you wind up with the kind of situation that Sheldrick and Wiseman ran into, where you have a guy like Richard Wiseman who's supposed to be a collaborator, but's really working at cross purposes to the project as a debunker in this case. And one of the reasons I think these things have happened in the past when skeptics and believers have tried to collaborate is this issue of authority not being clearly spelled out. Now, in the case of Wiseman and Sheldrick, that's really kind of letting Wiseman off the hook, because Sheldrick was clearly the principal investigator, and Wiseman was supposed to be replicating his results. But nonetheless, when you leave this authority thing hanging out there and it isn't wrestled to the ground, those issues can get murky, and you can wind up with one guy, Wiseman in this case, changing the experiment on the fly, never telling anyone, and you wind up with a real mess. It would be like in our case if Steve Novell and his group ran some trial in the medium experiment but decided to leave the recording part out. So maybe they decided, oh, we'll just give the medium the name but not do the recording. Well, that's not collaborating, and it's certainly not replicating. I mean, that's running a different experiment. And that's okay if you want to test a different claim, but you're not really collaborating on this experiment. You're doing your own. So we're going to make sure in this open source science experiment that we provide clear direction on the methods and the design of the experiment. And we're going to balance that, on the other hand, with a very open, responsive communication system about exactly what we're doing and exactly how decisions are being made that might be controversial or might require an extra level of debate, if you will, from the skeptics as well as from the believers. And that, I guess, leads right into two more issues that have come up about open source science's methods. And that has to do with speed and transparency. So over the last couple of weeks, I've gotten a number of comments along the lines of, when are we going to see more design documents? Where is the formal protocol? Where is the list of medium? What about results? How are you going to use the results? Well, the first thing I want to say about all these questions is that if you don't see something being done, raise your arm up and offer to do it. You'd be amazed at how open we are about having folks, even skeptics, as long as they're reasonable and open to working on a team, joining us. So that's first. Don't carp, do. And a lot of you are beginning to contribute in a meaningful way, so thanks for that. Of course, there's another part of that that I have to acknowledge, and that's that no matter how we do things, there's always going to be some lag time. Even a modest experiment like this one winds up having a lot of moving pieces, and the podcast only comes out every 2 weeks, and the forum only gets updated when it gets updated. So not everyone's going to immediately know what everyone else is doing, and there's going to be some lag time. But I think it's dramatically less than what you'd normally see. And then with regard to transparency, that's really easy. There are going to be some decisions and information that we can't make public, either because it will be an intrusion on someone's privacy or because it would screw up the experiment. But everything else is fair game. Ask away, and we'll do our best to answer. And again, I think this is a big step forward. I mean, compare that to what happened again in the Sheldrick Wiseman case. Compare it on the two levels that I just talked about, speed and transparency. First off, speed. Well, that was out of the question in that case. If you remember, Wiseman bopped in, borrowed Sheldrick's camera, secretly changed the protocol, ran four trials, and then he locked himself away for a couple of years without talking to anyone while he tried to cobble together something that he could get published and promote. And as far as transparency, well, again, I spent the better part of three episodes trying to unravel the subterfuge and game playing that was involved. So there's no need to repeat it here. But the point of all this is simple, and I think it's profound, and I think it's going to become more and more profound as we move forward. And that's that we're onto something here. I firmly believe that the open source concept that we're applying to this experiment is a real model for how we can improve things from the way that they've been done in the past, and how we can kind of break through this stalemate that sometimes winds up happening with controversial research. I think the results that we wind up with from doing it this way are going to be better, and we're all going to have more confidence in them. Okay, so enough about process. That's kind of part one. Let's talk about what we're actually doing. So the next part of this podcast today, I want to talk a little bit about the experiment. I want to talk about some of the early results we're getting and where those results are driving us to go in the future. And then after that, of course, we are going to hear from Stephanie A. Stevens, and we have a very interesting dialogue coming up about how we've worked together on the experiment. So that's coming up in just a minute here on Skeptico.
Open, I can feel the breeze coming through. The only thing on my mind.
Okay, welcome back. I wanted to pick things right up where I left off and begin talking about the process that I've gone through in getting this experiment started. And let me give you a little bit of a chronology. In September of 2008, I moved out of the planning and talking phase of this experiment and went out and started recruiting participants for the experiment. And then in October, I settled on the first medium that I wanted to work with, and that was Stephanie, who you'll hear from in just a minute. And when I first started working with Stephanie, the model that I had in my head was really more or less the experiment that Dr. Julie Beischel had done that many of you heard about in the previous episode of Skeptico. So I had read the description of how she had done the experiments with Gary Schwartz, University of Arizona, how she had followed those up with experiments she had done at Winbridge. I even was availing myself of her mediums. Stephanie A. Stevens was one of the mediums she had certified. She had also been certified at the University of Arizona. So I thought that was naturally a great place to start. So in the first couple of sessions that I had with Stephanie back in October, I was basically following the protocol that had been done in the past. I was playing the role of the proxy sitter. I had the information about the deceased person, and I was asking Stephanie a series of questions, as you would do in a reading, about personality and about physical characteristics and all these things. She, on the other hand, was doing the reading part and trying to connect with the deceased. And well, it just wasn't working. And it wasn't working for a couple of reasons. First off, I found it hard for me, the proxy sitter, to really keep my stuff out of it. I mean, even if you're blinded from the data, you're still interacting with this person about something that's very personal and very emotional, and it's just hard not to get pulled into it. But the other and really much bigger problem that I ran into is just how weird this whole process can be. Here I was doing these readings, and some of them are just stunningly accurate. They're just unbelievable. And then others are completely off. And that's not only throwing me for a loop, but it seems to be throwing Stephanie for a loop as well. And then sometimes it would get even weirder because the reading would be like way off. But then the next reading we would do, we would realize that, hey, some of that information, or really all that information from the previous reading that was way off, seemed to be a perfect fit for the next person we were doing the reading for. I mean, interesting stuff, but how do you turn that into an experiment that's really going to mean anything? So at any rate, I'm doing these experiments with Stephanie, and I'm not getting good results. And let me digress there for a minute. Let me digress and repeat myself. I wasn't getting good results. Now, I can almost hear people jumping through the internet and skeptical purists looking at that statement and saying, I have some kind of bias. Like, I had some expectation about how the experiment was supposed to be and it wasn't turning out. And well, of course I did. I mean, I went into this experiment believing that the prior evidence was compelling enough to do this experiment. And I went in believing that this phenomena really exists. And that's not necessarily a bad thing. It's just a reality. This idea that researchers are value-free or don't have a stake in the outcome is really one that has to be dispelled right up front because it's just total crap. I mean, the only obligation I have to science, I think, was best said by Dr. Steve Novella when he was on my show and he said, The goal is to design research in such a way that it doesn't matter what you believe. The results will be valid despite the beliefs of the researcher. Anyway, here I am. I'm doing these readings with Stephanie, and they're all over the place, and I'm trying to figure out how to make this thing work, how to isolate and measure this phenomena that I am seeing, because it is cropping up. And I know I need to get myself out of the process because that's not working. And I'm really starting to think that I need to get the real sitter out of the process as well because I can see the same problems cropping up if you asked this person who really is the sitter, who will almost certainly have some strong emotional feelings about the deceased, if we ask them to get in this process and start rating and start doing the same things that I'm doing as a proxy sitter, even if they're removed from the actual reading, I just felt like that whole situation was going to create problems and create bias in the experiment. And that's when we really got the idea to revamp the experiment into an online experiment where the sitter is completely out of the equation. It's just the medium and the recording, and that the sitter is completely out of the rating process as well, that we're not relying on them to decide how good or bad a particular piece of information is. We just ask the medium to match the recording to the deceased. And as I told you a little bit about last time, this really opened things up. I think this was really a key to this experiment, and it opened it up in a lot of ways. And one way that it opened up was that it really allowed us to reach out to more mediums and to a diversity of mediums. I mean, at this point, we've invited Wicca mediums. We've invited Christian mediums who do their mediumship through a connection with Christ consciousness. We've invited voodoo mediums and tarot card reader mediums and crystal user mediums and astrology mediums. And we're able to do all this because the experiment is very self-contained and the results are self-evident. Either you can do this or you can't do this. So we didn't have to really care too much what belief system you had that you were bringing to the table. All we wanted to do was measure anomalous cognition. And that's exactly how we ran the first trial. We basically took on all comers. We invited a variety of different mediums to try. They'd go through it, and then one by one, we'd interview them after they went through the trial, ask them what they liked, ask what they didn't like, and in particular, ask them how they thought that the experiment could be improved to have a better chance of tapping into what it is that they do. And here are some of the things that we learned that really helped us in refining the experiment for the second trial. Number one, the number one thing that mediums asked for, and it was easy to do, is longer messages. They wanted more time to tune into the sitter. So we lengthened a message by asking the sitter just to record some innocuous stuff like the day of the week and some other things that you can hear in the recording. This was easy to do and really doesn't compromise the experiment in any way. The second thing that we changed, and this was really a surprise, and I think it was a really big step forward, and it only came about through this iterative process of going through it and kind of working in the field with the mediums. And that is that we really moved away from the whole physical description thing because we found it very problematic. We found that when you describe a tall, thin, brown-haired person or brown-skinned person, that can mean so many different things, and that kind of information was actually more often than not kind of throwing the medium off, where they'd say, gee, I wasn't sure, and I saw some curly hair, and it said curly hair, and it just seemed to be confusing the process. The third suggestion that we responded to, and this may or may not be important, but it just kept coming up, so we started leaning in this direction, and this is some of the kind of art versus science thing that has come into this in working with mediums. But again, I think it's important to note that this is the kind of work that needs to be done. I mean, these are the folks that we're studying who we believe have demonstrated time and time again in natural settings that they have this ability to demonstrate this phenomena. So they're the experts. They're the ones we have to respond to. So what we heard was that outgoing, gregarious people, and to a certain extent, creative people, loud people, had a better chance of making a strong connection than maybe people who were more shy and were not as talkative. So we heard that enough that we felt like we should make that a factor in selecting participants, and we did. It's not an overriding factor, but it is something that we looked at, and I bring it up just to give you an insight into some of that process that we went through. So after a few tweaks in our methodology there, we were ready to go on with the second trial. And with the second trial, we had a smaller population of mediums, and that was somewhat self-selected. Some folks just didn't want to participate in the second one after going through the first one. And it was also through our encouragement. I mean, we kind of encouraged some mediums more than others based on how we thought they were doing and how we enjoyed relating with them. We're planning on being in this project for a while, so we really want to kind of focus on the people that we liked, and there's nothing wrong with that. So in this second trial, we had 13 mediums go through it thus far. So we went from 30 or 40 in the first one down to 13 in the second trial. And we're going to probably keep paring that down further based on the performance of the mediums and just further finding out who is really best suited for this kind of experiment. And then, as you know, at the same time, we also kicked off the skeptical trial where we ask you to go through and listen to the same recordings that the mediums hear and try and answer the same questions that they answer. And I'll talk a little bit more about that in a minute when we talk about the results. And let me just clarify something on that. The primary reason we set up the skeptical trial was in order to help us get a handle on this skeptical claim. The claim that what mediums do, they do through cold reading techniques like listening to accents or other subtle clues that are given by the sitter. So So what we wanted to do in the skeptical online experiment was give you the same recordings that the mediums hear, the same choices, and see if you can make those links of logic and deduction and tell us where there might be some ways to tighten up the experiment so that those leaks aren't there. And many of you have done that, and I thank you for it, and I'm going to have some more about that in just a minute. But first, let's talk about results, because a lot of folks keep asking me about the results, and I want to break the traditional science rule about not talking about results until they're published because, well, first of all, I think it's a stupid rule in a lot of cases like this one. And secondly, because I want to stay true to this concept of open sourcing and, in particular, the speed concept of cutting down the cycle time, getting you back in the loop, letting you know how things are going, because that's part of the process in terms of you evaluating where this experiment needs to go. So let's start with some of the basics. The online trial asks you to match four recordings with four descriptions. The odds of you getting all of those right is 4 factorial. That is 4 × 3 × 2 × 1. The odds that you get the first one right are 1 out of 4. Then after that, the odds that you get the next one right is 1 out of 3, 1 out of 2. You multiply that out. The odds that you get all of them right is 1 out of 24. And that's what we're looking for from the mediums. Get them all right. So you have a 1 out of 24 chance of getting them all right. What are the odds if you have a bunch of mediums doing the experiment? What are the kind of combinatorial odds? Well, at first it's easy. Let's say you had 24 mediums going through the trial. What are the chances that one of them would get all of them right? Well, the odds are even. They're at chance level. 24 mediums, odds 1 out of 24, someone's bound to get it right. So in our case, we had 13 mediums go through the trial, and we had 6 of them get all of them right. So what do you suppose the odds against chance are of having that many mediums get all the answers right? Okay, I'm not going to pretend like I knew this. I had to go and dig this up myself. But there's actually a formula for doing this. It's not too difficult of a formula. I'll go ahead and post it on the Skeptico blog so you can take a look. But the odds are actually quite amazing. The bottom line is that the odds against chance of 6 out of 13 mediums scoring 4 out of 4 correct is over 100,000 to 1. So wow, that's pretty big. But while it's encouraging and certainly very impressive, I want to also keep that in perspective. I mean, first, it's very, very early on in this experiment. We're at trial 2. We're definitely run trial 3 and trial 4. And then hopefully we're going to get Steve Novella's team on board, and we're going to go through several trials with them as well, maybe 3 or 4 trials with them. So there's a lot more to do. But as far as results, the early results suggest that we're heading in the right direction and that we might be able to get something that's going to be meaningful. Because again, one of the things that I said last episode, and I'd reiterated here, the only way that this thing, I think, even becomes interesting is if you get these really dramatic results. Slightly better isn't really going to cut it. Which maybe brings us back to the skeptical results, right? At the time of this recording, we've had about 40, 41 people go through the skeptical trial. No one has gone 4 for 4. But we did get some very valuable observations that have made us rethink and tweak the design a little bit. So let me give you a little idea of how that's worked its way in. Remember, we asked you to look for potential bias, ways that you could connect the recording to the choices. And one of the first things you focused on was the relationship between names and age. Now, we had given that some consideration going in, but your observations really caused us to reexamine that and I think shore it up. And here's where we're at on that now. We take all the names of the deceased persons who are being targeted in this experiment, and we analyze their name for popularity. And we found a great site that produces this really cool histogram that shows you the years that that particular name was most popular. And I'll provide a link to that in the show notes as well, so you have access to that. It's really quite fascinating stuff. Anyways, with that information at hand, we look for names that are distinctly younger names or older names. So for example, in the very first trial that we did, we had 2 individuals in there. One was named Zach and one was named Cooper. Those 2 names, Zach and Cooper, wind up skewing for younger names. Those names became very popular in the late 70s and the early 1980s. So you can work out the math and figure out how old that person is likely to be. So here's what we do inside the experiment. If the targeted deceased has either a younger name or an older name, we balance that out so that overall, in all the names that we choose over all the trials, the chance that a younger name, like Zach, really does correspond to a younger person is right around chance. So I'll just tell you, in Zach's case, we actually had two Zachs as participants. One was a 76-year-old farmer, and one was a young kid in his late teens or early 20s. So that's how the experiment is going to work. If you see a younger name or an older name, and we will identify those names as either younger names or older names, well, then you will know that we've kind of rigged it so that that name really has no greater than a chance level of really corresponding to someone who is, in fact, older or younger. Is that clear? I don't know. I hope so. The second thing related to age that you picked up on right away, and this was really good because I don't think we had totally thought this all the way through, and that was the age relationship between the sitter, the person who's making the recording, and the targeted deceased. And what we decided to do there was, again, provide you an assurance that folks will be evenly divided among the kind of generations. Here's what I mean. Approximately one-third of the sitters and the targeted deceased will be a parent trying to connect with a child. Approximately one-third will be a child trying to connect with a parent or a grandparent. And approximately one-third will be someone trying to connect with someone who is either a sibling or a friend or who is basically of the same generation. So those two controls and tightening those up, I think, really helps us get a better handle on this age thing. There's still some combinations that you could probably make in terms of inferring there, but I think anyone who does so would be very hard-pressed to get anything more than chance results by going strictly on the age thing as it relates to the names. So there's a specific way where the involvement of you, the listener, the participant in the skeptical experiment, has really helped this project. Now, beyond the age thing, the other factor that was brought out by the skeptical trial was some of the other very clever connections that people made between sitters and targeted deceased. For example, one person pointed out that one of the descriptions referred to the deceased liking motocross, and she tied that to the fact that one of the sitters had a southern accent. And she said, you know, I think motocross is much more popular in the South, and therefore I'm making that connection. Well, I'm not even going to say whether that connection is true or not, but I think it's the kind of inference that is very clever and could be made. And what it did for us was say, how can we in the future write up these descriptions so they're even more generic, so they're purged from as much information as possible that could make those kind of connections? Now, at the same time, I have to say that some of those connections that people made, and they did a great job of trying, I think we're not really going to worry too much about. For example, in trial two, some folks noticed that one of the sitters had an accent, and some folks pegged it as a New Zealand accent, some folks pegged it as Australian, some as South African. But at any rate, they said, I think it's a New Zealand accent, and there's a lot of mountains in New Zealand. And one of the descriptions says that the deceased person liked to climb mountains, so I'm going to make that connection. Well, the interesting thing there is someone else made exactly a different inference about the Australian accent. They said, I hear an Australian accent, and I think Australia has a lot of guns. I'm going to connect that with the gunshot victim. Okay, and I'm not going to say whether either one of those are correct. My point is that you were doing exactly what we asked you to do, and that is try and use logic and deduction to tie the reading to the description. What I'm pointing out is we looked at all those and we really took those to heart and tried to see if there's any way we can use those connections you're making to try and improve the descriptions we're making by making them less descriptive, but still descriptive enough for mediums to make the connection. And I think that process is working. Okay, so enough on that. Hope that fills you in a little bit on the inside story behind the experiment. And I particularly hope that that motivates you to become even more involved and give us more of your time, effort, and ideas about how we can make this experiment better. So next up, I want to introduce you to someone who I've really enjoyed working with on this project and is really, really a neat person who I've come to like very much. And that's Stephanie A. Stevens, a medium and healer from Tucson, Arizona. My interview with her coming up in just a minute here on Skeptico. So, Stephanie, thank you for joining me here today on Skeptico.
Great to be here, Alex. Thank you for having me.
It's a delight. And as I mentioned before in the introduction, which you didn't hear, Stephanie, but I'm going to play for everyone else, Stephanie Stevens is a medium located in Tucson, Arizona. She has excellent credentials as a medium in that she's participated in the experiments with Gary Schwartz at the University of Arizona, and most recently in the experiments at the Winbridge Institute with Julie Beischel. So, Stephanie, it's been a real delight getting to know you and working with you, and I thought it'd be a great opportunity to take a minute and introduce your work to our listeners, since we are talking more and more about this medium experiment that we've been doing. So where I thought we might start is a little conversation we were having right before we started this interview, and that is just a little bit about your background in terms of the work that you do and how you got started doing medium communication.
When I was about 5 years old, and I told you about the OM and my parents raising me in a metaphysical household, and I began to see spirit forms and things like that when I was about 5. Actually, before that, about 3. And when I came to meditate and be introduced to meditation by my parents, and also learned my ability actually to send the OM, I know that that activated something within me.
Stephanie, let me interject here because I want you to take a minute and talk a little bit about the OM. And I know that's going to really throw some people for a loop. I have to tell you, we have a pretty skeptical, scientifically minded audience. But I think it's very interesting, and of course, it resonated with me because I'm a longtime yoga practitioner. But maybe in simple terms, tell folks a little bit about what the OM is and what that means to you specifically.
Well, the OM is a property. Actually, it's a healing force, but it's known in the Bible as the Amen of God. It's also known in through the Vedas and the in Hindu belief that it's the voice and sound of God. The AUM is the voice and sound of God, the universal force that's reverberating around us all the time. And I was born with the ability to pull in from source, to activate it within my own body, basically, and broadcast it out. So it means I hear it simultaneously and send it out at the same time. And it's proven itself to have healing ability. It's proven itself to be a kinetic force. And for me, it meant that I was hearing this thing and activating it. My mom told me this when I was 5 years old, oh, that's the OM, because when I was 5, I just activated it. And I didn't know what I was doing. I was simply remembering something that I knew how to do. It probably was initiated in several lifetimes ago, who knows. And then I just went around probably protecting myself with this and wondering what the sound was when I would hear it and then send it out. And it was over like 40 years later, and I began to send it to clients and found out more about it, that it was a power unto itself, moved from place to place. And now, in 2005, a doctor heard about this and began to send terminal cancer patients to me long distance where I had no knowledge. They had no knowledge of me or the OM. And cancer depression was removed immediately. And then they began to heal. And some of them, a lot of them, there's a 95% recovery from terminal cancer. I didn't, in some cases, I didn't even know their names or know anything that was going on with them, and simply just said, okay, send it to this person. And today I have a healing practice. 2005, someone else that works for Immune Recovery Wellness in Tucson heard about it through this and hired me to work on her horses and some people. So I have a weekly patient who's a horse. So it's for people and animals. But at the same time, what I believe is when it's activated and everything is that it goes into a much higher realm, and I believe that it pulls in people. In fact, I know it pulls in people from the other side.
Great, great. Now that we've totally freaked out probably about 70% of my skeptical audience, which is fine. It's just fine. It really is, because I think that, you know, part of the challenge, but also the opportunity of venturing into this research and doing it in a controlled way is you have to be open to following the data, like I always say. So what we've done is tried to design an experiment that either works or it doesn't work. And if it works, what I'd say is it has to cause folks to then step back and say, well, wait a minute, I just heard that whole thing on the ohm and it doesn't match with any of my personal experience, and it certainly goes against my belief system. But what if she's right? And I have this kind of hard evidence over here that says mediums are able to do this kind of anomalous cognition thing that we don't have a good explanation for. So I'll tell you where I'd like to take that kind of little rambling on my part. Tell us a little bit about your experience doing research in this area.
Actually, Alex, it started with me putting my name, and I met Gary Schwartz in 2003 at a talk at Sunrise Chapel in Tucson, and he found out that I was a medical intuitive and told me to put my name in for the waiting list for the medical human energy system lab or medical intuition type program at the University of Arizona. And I did, and then I heard back from them, and they were delayed or something to this effect. After that, I think I went online and just said something about myself and sent it, and it was very strange how that happened, because it took almost five years. Suddenly there was a letter that came in the mail and said, we invite you to become certified.
Okay, so you went through this process with Gary Schwartz at the University of Arizona, and then that research went on for a couple of years, then it wound down, and then as folks who listen to this show know, Julie Beischel has picked it up at the Winbridge Institute, and then you've done some work with her as well. Is that right?
That's right. Actually, got certified in October 10th, 2006, so I've been certified over 2 years with Veritas and the whole process that way. And then in January of 2007, due to lack of funding, Veritas ended, and Julie invited some of us, the ones that were with Veritas, some of the mediums, to go on board with Winbridge, and that's an 8-step process, and we got certified with that. And we're also I'm also certified with the Forever Family Foundation, and that's a kind of automatic thing once you are certified with Veritas.
Great. All that's great background, and that's, of course, how I came to know you. I came to know you through Julie Beischel and her website. I found all the mediums there, and then I contacted Julie, and we had a couple of really good conversations that have been broadcast on this show. So all this medium work you've done, you know, and as we were just mentioning earlier, and I forgot to mention, you have a new book coming out called Growing Up Medium, which is a great title, and it tells all about your experiences growing up and then your practice in mediumship. So we'll mention that again, maybe talk a little bit about that at the end of this interview. But what I wanted to talk about next was what I was just leading up to, and that's the experiment that we've been doing here at Open Source Science. And I'm not going to drag them through every of the recordings of every interview and reading session that we did, but I want to give people a little bit of a sense for how we kind of scrambled around with this thing and how absolutely open and wonderful you were about working with me and trying various different techniques that we went through in doing that. So do you maybe want to recall or recount as best you can some of the things that we tried and some of the ways that we worked on this experiment that we've been doing for Open Source Science?
Yes. I remember that, you know, it's kind of like sort of a touch and go thing. For me, you know, there was a series, like with Veritas for one thing, and also with Winbridge, the processors, you give the name, the person's name of, you know, and it's a gender and it's female or male. How did they pass? What were their hobbies, their personality, and so on and so forth? And, there was a first experiment where that was happening, and then I remember that more than one name was given, and I'm just going to talk about how you learn to use the skill to be able to hone right in.
Well, I think, as I recall, we tried a couple of different things in
right.
terms of one, starting with the names, where I gave you all four names, and then I gave you, was it this or was it this? Did they die of cancer? I have one that ran their car into a tree, or this or that. And in the process of doing those readings, we kind of discovered what was working and what wasn't working. And I think we also discovered just part of the process that we have to go through. And the process that part of the process is, as you mentioned, that you seem to be getting a lot of information, and part of your challenge is deciding where that information fits. So you might be doing a reading for one person, and you think you're doing a reading for one person, a lot of information's coming through, and then lo and behold, we get to the next person, and that information turns out to be a perfect fit for them rather than the person the first time. So,
right.
You know, I learned a lot from that process, and I think that was a really vital, necessary process to what we've evolved into with the online experiment and the recordings being online.
I actually found it interesting to listen to the audio recorded voices of the sitters. But what happened, I remember one particular thing, having a dream of bleachers in baseball, and the next day come to find out that this is what the person was, the sitter that was trying to contact the loved one, possibly the loved one coming through, because that's exactly what they had done, and there was that dream. And there's no way you can just kind of ignore those things. I really appreciate these experiments because they have taught me to use my abilities and even just to, like I said, zero in on this. And it's funny because, remember, back in 1971 or something, when my mom was just giving me names of people, living people then, but just testing me, that's how I would do it. I just thought, okay, this is what they look like, this is their hobby, this is where they, you know, this kind of thing. And that, I went back to that simplistic type thing, and it was way easier.
Stephanie, is that a story that you've written about in your book?
I believe it is, yes.
Because I thought that was, again, your book coming out is titled Growing Up Medium. And when we first started talking and you were telling me a little bit about your background, one of the things that I just thought was fascinating, given the way that we're doing this experiment and the way it matched up with your background, is this way that your mom would test you, and that you'd walk in the room and just give you a name and make you do a reading. And then I think you told a great story about how your dad, who was much more skeptical because he was more of a scientifically oriented guy, he even tried it one time, and his skepticism was kind of challenged by that. Is that a story you feel comfortable talking about? Or?
Oh, absolutely. I think we touch on that in the book, in the first part. What happened is that, you know, my mom, you know, she recognized abilities and had taken me to spiritual people in their spiritual meditation-type circles, and also, shall we say, some spiritualist-type people and psychics, mediums, whatever, and taken me to one of the main Ghostbusters of our, well, generation, I guess, Hazel Denning, who was training psychics and mediums at the time. And that, you know, that through that encouragement, that launched me into doing readings. But without any warning, my mom just would walk in, and I'd be sitting there, and she'd say, okay, John Doe, or, you know, John Lewis or something. Or not even the last name. And then that happened, and that went on for quite a few, I guess, number of months. And then my dad said, well, you know, I'm going to try this. And he gave me one of his undergraduate students, and I just immediately described the man. And then there was this immediate physical itching that took place. And I said, Dad, I'm itching. And he said, you know, the man just got an allergy yesterday. There's no way that you could have known that, you know, he has an allergy, and he's broken out all over his body. He said, well, you've got me, you almost got me here. You've got me pretty convinced here. And, you always want the encouragement of your parents. And my dad told me one time, he said, I think you're the exception to the rule. And this is a person who actually, you know, lived in Sedona and said, well, I don't want to make him sound critical or anything, but he's seen things that he feels is fraudulent, some channeling and things like that. And he's pretty outspoken about it, like, no, this is not truly, truly spiritual. But there, he told me, he said, I just tell my friends, the people who ask about you, and he just said this recently, Alex, he said that my daughter has some things, abilities that I cannot explain. And I think that that's probably the best way to put that.
Right. And, you know, I think that maybe that's a good way to kind of end up our discussion today. But I really have to say that explanation from a scientifically minded person, like your dad, and I'm certainly not picking on your dad, but we just hear that all the time. That should not be the end of the discussion. That should be the beginning of the discussion.
Oh, absolutely.
And too often it's the end. It's, we can't explain it. Well, we can't explain it because we haven't tried to explain it. We haven't applied our best methods and means of science to doing it. And that's really a shame, but that's something that hopefully with your help, we will kind of further advance. Well, thank you so much especially for participating in the experiment, which is ongoing, and you will be helping us out more in the future, but also for joining us today on Skeptico. Thanks, Stephanie.
Well, thank you, Alex.
Well, thanks again to Stephanie A. Stevens for joining me here on Skeptico. If you'd like more information about Stephanie, be sure to check out our website. That's SKEPTIKO. You'll also find the other links I mentioned in this show, as well as links to all our previous shows in our archives, and of course, a link to the Skeptico Forum. Well, that's going to do it for today. Much more coming up in the next few weeks. Stay with us, take care, and bye for now.